Good morning or afternoon to everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here and to speak to you today. So we got tasked by DAZ to actually give this small introduction. I'm not a DAZ expert. I'm a freelance consultant, but I spent many years with DAZ. I joined in 2008, worked most of my time in the beginning more on climate adaptation, later more mitigation in the last few years, mostly on climate finance. I spent a few years in the headquarters and then in the Philippines and in Indonesia. And since 2018, I'm an independent consultant. Very happy to be here today. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe Sally?
Sure, I can go ahead. Thanks so much. Hi, everyone. Thanks, Krishna and Rasmus, for organizing this and inviting us to talk with you all today about climate financing. My name's Sally Lacey. I have my former experience working with the GIZ. I worked for many years in Germany on a global program, the Global Climate Policy Advisory Program. But I have since relocated a little further south. So, and just by chance, Ulla and I are both further south in Zurich, Switzerland now. So even though we both worked together for a time at GIZ in the headquarters, we are now both in Switzerland. And I work for a company called EBP as a climate project leader. And I'm very happy to be brought back into the GIZ world for this event today. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Sally. Ina, over to you.
Yes, I could. Thank you very much. My name is Ina Davisse. I work for GIZ. I lead one and very soon two programs of GIZ where we work together with the European Investment Bank. So it is specifically on finance for infrastructure, but specifically climate-friendly or climate-resilient, climate change-resilient infrastructure. So one of these instruments I will introduce to you later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ina. So I think we will start. I projected my screen. Can you all see the in full screen?
I see it, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. So I'll hand over to you and I'll mute myself because sometimes there are echoes. So just let me know when you want to move to the next slide. And
okay.
And concerning questions, so basically we will do a short introduction. I mean, the first introductory part. Then Ina will present to us her part. And then probably we'll stop there and take some questions after Ina's presentation, and then we can continue the presentation and take up the other questions in a second round. Okay, over to you.
Sure, I'm actually going to get us started, so I'll take the baton from you, Krishna. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll turn, I don't know if it makes sense for me to turn off my video, no one is seeing me anyway, if everyone's looking at the screen. So I guess I will just start by saying before we launch into this presentation that I'm often struck by the sheer enormity of the challenge that lies ahead of us in terms of transforming the way that we live so that we can be climate compatible. The numbers are pretty staggering when we sit down and start thinking about what needs to be done to rethink particularly global infrastructure as the topic today. As we know, on the one hand, infrastructure is a key driver for growth and employment and better quality of life in countries all over the world. But on the other hand, it comes with a cost. Approximately 70% of greenhouse gas emissions come from infrastructure construction and operations like power plants and buildings in the transport sector. To use a metaphor, I think it's sort of like thinking of a train. Like, we all know that it's not easy to turn a train around quickly. It feels like the world right now is aboard a very heavy diesel-powered freight train that is speeding in the wrong direction in terms of climate protection. And this diesel train actually needs to make a pretty sharp U-turn. But we also need to keep the train on the rails while we turn it, or we're going to make our, if we're going to make our infrastructure greener. And I guess I should mention that the train also needs to be retrofitted to work on clean energy instead of diesel while it's making its U-turn. The thing is, this is going to cost a lot of money. So the world will need approximately $85 trillion in low carbon climate resilient infrastructure if we're going to meet the Paris Climate Change Agreement. The goal of keeping global average temperature increase well below 2 degrees. We'll get back to that in a minute. So anyway, this is all to say that I'm glad that you all are here and that you share an interest in making your infrastructure projects greener and more resilient. So as Krishna mentioned, Ula, Ina, and I want to provide some background information on the international climate landscape and then present you with various financing sources that are dedicated to low carbon climate resilient development. Unfortunately, these funds are certainly not going to get us to that $85 trillion mark that's needed to transform this global infrastructure, but they present financing options that will hopefully lead to continuous increases in investment over time. So that being said, I think we can get started. Krishna, if you click us to our overview slide, I'm going to just in the beginning, bring us up to speed on the climate trends, the greenhouse gases and that sort of thing, and the impacts, as well as give an overview of the global response. And this is going to be followed by some presentations of several different funds by Ina and Ula, at which point there will be some time for discussion and questions before we move into this actual project examples and some additional resources at the end. So next slide, please. I think it would not be a proper climate presentation if we don't at least start with a little reminder of where we're standing and what's at stake in terms of the climate. So this upward trajectory is showing us where we would be heading in terms of temperature increase if there were no policies. So without climate policies, we're heading towards a 4.5 degree centigrade increase above the pre-industrial levels by the end of this century. Luckily, it's not quite that bad. At the moment, we're looking at current policies that are that have us more on a 3 degree trajectory. But the bad news is that is not really good news. If you know, I'm sure that you all have your own experiences and observations of things that you've seen in your own lives and working environment of what it's been like with the 1 degrees that we've had so far. And so I think we can all agree that we don't want to see 3 degrees. We're talking about pretty devastating impacts. 4 degrees, we're talking global cities around the world being underwater. We're talking mass extinction of species, extreme events, even more so than what we're seeing already. So I think we can agree that we don't want to go there. So next slide, please. This next one just kind of shows us the it's a daunting task ahead. We see that if we want to get down to this 1.5 to range, that this line has to go from where it's currently heading, which is still up, to pretty much straight downhill. We need to get really down to zero. That's why we often hear people talking about net zero at this point, because we really need to eliminate emissions from our lives. They are bad for us. So I don't want to go into the details of this, only to say that we've got a big job ahead of us if we're going to keep temperature rise below 2 degrees, and there will be significant reductions that need to happen in our greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, you all in your work have an important role to play with that. Next slide, please. I just want to quickly mention, because really the two ways that we get there, the two responses that we talk about when we're talking about climate change, of course, are the mitigation responses. So this is where we actually try to deal with those emissions. We want to reduce emissions. We want to reduce the magnitude of the climate change. But on the other hand, we want to, or we have to adapt, because we are already seeing these changes. So we still need to try to reduce the vulnerabilities, reduce the losses in any way that we can. So that's why we see mitigation and adaptation as complementary strategies to any response to climate change, And as we get to project examples later, you'll see how those two often play together to get to the ultimate goal of the project. Next slide, please. So this is sort of the reality check where we are. These are, when we're talking about mitigation of greenhouse gases, what needs to really be done at a sectoral level to limit global warming to below 1.5 degrees. We have these primary sectors here listed, like our energy sector, buildings, industry, transport, agriculture. Some pretty extreme reductions have to happen in all of these sectors. For instance, we're doing pretty well on renewables. That has to be sustained. We have to just say no to coal-fired power plants. There just cannot be anymore. We have to say goodbye to fossil fuel cars. The last one should be sold by 2035. We really need to figure out new ways to do aviation and shipping. One that I find to be particularly interesting and remarkable is this one about the buildings. We really should not be building a single building more that is not a zero emissions building. And as we can see, this was foreseen for 2020. Well, we're already in 2020. And unfortunately, I don't think we're there yet. But this is just the reality that we are talking about if we want to stave off the worst effects of climate change. Let's see, any other ones worth mentioning here? Of course, we need to improve our agriculture practices and use forests better to reduce emissions as carbon sinks, excuse me. So next slide, please. These next two slides, we are kind of latecomers to our presentation. We just added them because we thought it's interesting and also thinking that Ina would be with us today and has the city perspective. A lot of this infrastructure work that we're talking about is going to have to happen in cities. And so when we look, first of all, it's interesting to maybe do a comparison and see where the emissions are. On the left side, we can see on the one hand that OECD countries have kind of stabilized more or less in terms of their CO2 emissions. And the green line is showing non-OECD countries where you can clearly see the trend towards growing CO2 emissions. Whereas on the right side, we see information about energy consumption where in both categories, it's increasing over time. But the fact that it can increase and yet the emissions don't increase for OECD tells us that there is a greater share of renewables coming online in OECD and that the non-OECD countries maybe have some catching up to do. But we also see that this energy consumption is primarily happening in cities. So that again puts cities in sort of the center of our focus when we want to get, let's say, the most bang for our buck. Next slide, please. Which also looks at how cities can reduce CO2 emissions. So this is a little bit of a repetition of what we just looked at in terms of sectoral work, but we definitely see the need to focus on urban planning in terms of increasing or improving urban design, making it more compact and dense, climate-friendly building codes, et cetera. As I mentioned, the buildings themselves really have to become zero emission. That will involve better materials and design, efficiency in their cooling and heating, the appliances and the lighting that they use. Mobility, we need to think about non-fossil fuel options, so creating walkable spaces, compact spaces, mixed-use neighborhoods, that sort of thing, but also increasing the share of electric vehicles. Energy, we're looking at sustaining renewable energy, increasing it, reducing the amount of renewables that are being rolled out. There's also work to be done in the waste sectors and the waste and sewage in terms of reducing waste, but also seeing ways to convert it to energy. So all things where I think also within your work in the infrastructure world that you can find hopefully some inspiration for things that you could do moving forward. Next slide, please. So I mentioned the mitigation, but we also have the other side of the coin, the other side of the strategy, which is adaptation. We know that these impacts are already happening. We're already seeing you know, things like sea level rise. We're seeing deaths related to heat. We're seeing people displaced because of extreme events. So these are all things that the world is grappling with. And so we have to think about how to make infrastructure resilient to climate change as well. So on the one hand, people talk about technical solutions. Do we need to build more dikes? Do we need to be more efficient with our irrigation systems and that sort of thing? But there are also things that could be done in the realm of research, getting climate information, creating climate resilient breeds and species, what capacity development needs are there within the ministries that are working on these issues. So lots of different entry points for working on adaptation as well. Okay, next slide. So all of this climate crisis, of course, is being discussed on a regular basis globally, and the UNFCCC, that's the Framework Convention on Climate Change, is of course the body that's organizing these talks. And I'm sure everyone is aware that in 2015, there was this great breakthrough in Paris, and we have now this Paris Agreement that is the first time that we actually have this global agreement on how we're going to move forward. It's a framework agreement on how we can move forward. So we can have a look on the next slide for a little more detail on that. So on the one hand, Paris is telling us we definitely want to keep warming below 2 degrees. We are striving for 1.5 degrees. We're going for greenhouse gas neutrality. We need to be ambitious in our actions. We're also on the adaptation front, wanting to strengthen the ability to adapt to the negative effects of climate change. So this is remarkable in the sense that this is the first time that we have a binding climate treaty for 195 states under international law. And what is perhaps more interesting for us today in our talk about climate finance is that we're really seeing a push towards redirecting financial flows towards positive climate outcomes. So thinking about how public money can be used more effectively for climate outcomes, thinking how public money can be used to leverage more private financing for positive climate outcomes. And then we're seeing how this is having a ripple effect through the whole financial system. So not just donors that are increasing their climate funds, but we're seeing how that's playing out in the multilateral development banks. We're seeing how it's playing out with private investors, with institutional investors. And so it's an interesting time, and also an interesting time to get on board and try to develop some good project proposals that can attract some of this newly available climate financing. So one thing that I want to spend a minute on is this nationally determined contribution. This is at the heart of the Paris Climate Agreement. It is, I'm not sure if it's 190 countries exactly, but these countries have put forth their what they say they can do to contribute to this keeping warming below 2 degrees. And this is what they're committed to and what they want to implement over the coming years. Now, the catch is that this is not going to be enough. So if you switch to the next slide, please. We see that, That's fine. No, we can go to that. I'm going to come back to the NDC in just a second. I'm sorry. I realize that's the next slide. But this actually builds on what I was just saying in terms of the turning tide of climate finance. So I had mentioned that the MDBs, so the multilateral development banks, are also trying to redirect their funding to be more supportive of positive climate outcomes. And this is just some examples of how that's playing out. So the MDBs have said, and this is, there's a joint working group as part of their efforts to align with the Paris Agreement. So they're saying they want to align with the mitigation goals of the Paris Agreement, that they want their operations to screen projects for climate resilience, that they want to accelerate climate finance by scaling up the amount of finance that is being dedicated to climate outcomes. And so all of these things are just different ways that the MDBs are also engaging. And we wanted to mention this because the funds that we're going to talk about today are even in addition to what is happening within the multilateral development banks. And these MDBs will be particularly crucial for you all in your work if you're trying to develop infrastructure projects, because it won't be just about doing capacity development. You'll also need some hardware, I assume. And that's where these MDBs can, of course, be very useful partners in project design. So now we can jump forward. And I wanted to just mention this, stress the role of the NDCs, which, as I mentioned, are at the heart of the Paris Agreement. On the one hand, they're incredibly important because they're saying what the countries are willing to do, their part to reduce emissions and adapt to climate change. But on the other hand, they're not enough. So if you look at our little thermometer here on the right, we can see that the pledges and targets currently, if they are the only things that get implemented, we're still going to hit 3 degrees. So they're not enough to get us to below 2 degrees. But an important mechanism that was built into the Paris Agreement is that the NDCs should be ratcheted up over time. So this, they call it the ambition mechanism. So every 5 years, the countries are supposed to revisit their NDCs and say, well, actually, we think we can do more in this regard, or be more ambitious on this topic, and then resubmit a new NDC so that it's always becoming more ambitious over time. All right, that is on the topic of NDCs. And I think I just have one more slide before I hand over, and that is there was some interest in, that's the animation, take your cues from the NDCs. So when you're developing your projects, think about, is my project idea in line with the NDCs? And I say that because all donors, all banks are looking to support the NDCs. They really want to say, we're supporting the countries in implementing their NDCs. So when you're coming up with your project ideas and you're looking for financing from this development bank or that climate fund, they're going to want to see how this is supportive of the NDC. So that's why we just wanted to stress this policy instrument in particular. Thank you. Now you can click it forward one more. Good. So, of course, now we have a special year of 2020. It was supposed to be the year that kicked off a decade of climate action. Instead, we have seen a year of distraction, I guess you could say, as most governments around the world have shifted their attention to coping with this COVID-19 pandemic. So on the one hand, people are saying, well, it's been good for climate because it has reduced the amount of emissions, but I think no one thinks that that is the long-term solution to climate change. I think we still need to think about how we can recover from COVID in a climate-friendly way. So this idea of green recovery has emerged as the sort of the new buzzword in terms of how are we going to rebound from this COVID crisis, but also at the same time use all of the stimulus money that's coming in to accelerate our ecological transition, which we need for climate and biodiversity outcomes. So green recovery is really about keeping both climate and COVID on the radar. On the one hand, we see decision makers really thinking, okay, how are we going to restore purchasing power? How are we going to create new jobs? And how are we going to prioritize the least well off? And at the same time, I'm being told that I need to save the planet. So it's really about trying to do both at the same time. There is an unprecedented amount of money that is being put on the table in terms of mobilizing for this recovery. So that number of $10 trillion is even from May. I don't even know. It's a huge amount of money. And there's still time to influence how that is being used. So then the question becomes, is it going to be used for business as usual, or is it going to be used to have low carbon climate resilient investments? And on the right, I just put a few initiatives or activities that have been going on in recent months that you're welcome to look more into. I think on the one hand, this IGCC, this is a investor group. So this is really coming from the private sector. They're urging governments to ensure that economic response to the pandemic is aligned with the Paris Agreement. This sustainable recovery report, this was created some waves in the summer when it was published. So it's really saying that we need to focus reforms on the energy generation and consumption to have a sustainable recovery from COVID. They see it as a way to create jobs, green jobs, and that this is the way that we have to move forward. The NDC partnership is another initiative which is really focused on implementing NDCs, but at the same time, in the face of the pandemic, they're actually sending experts out to finance ministries around the world to support them in their decision making and how they're going to use stimulus money. The EU Green Recovery is another one. An alliance was formed of the 12 EU environmental ministries, plus major banks and insurance companies. And they're saying they really want to focus on how we're going to make this COVID recovery compatible with good climate outcomes through energy retrofits, through decarbonizing mobility, decarbonizing energy, et cetera. So those are just a few examples that I wanted to bring in. But at this point, I've talked a lot. I'm going to stop. And I'm actually going to hand it over to Ulla, who's going to get us into the topic that I think you guys actually joined this call for, which is the climate financing. So I think, Ulla, I can hand it over to you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Sally. Yeah, thanks for getting us on the right track of what needs to be done in terms of mitigation and adaptation, and for also explaining the international policy framework, which is important here to understand where these climate finance institutions, we're going to spend a bit of time now talking about, are located, and to see that against the background indeed of the international objectives and targets in terms of mobilizing climate finance for addressing the challenge ahead when it comes to climate change. Yes, so we now go a bit deeper into the topic. I'm going to spend just a few seconds on the question of a definition. What is actually climate finance? Then look at the climate finance landscapes, some funds that are relevant for this audience, hopefully. And speak a little bit about which instruments are being commonly used. And yeah, then we see if we have more time, we have more topics to think to talk about. Otherwise, you will receive more material as a follow-up to this seminar. And perhaps I also turn my video off because I'm actually distracting myself. So thank you, Krishna, for guiding us through this presentation. Yeah, excellent. So what is climate finance actually? There's no official definition, interestingly enough, because it is a bit of a contested topic in the international negotiations. However, the Standing Committee, which is an expert group that advises the international community on climate finance, says that it should aim at reducing emissions, enhancing things, reducing vulnerability, increasing resilience, so pretty much mitigation, adaptation, carbon sinks. Then there was quite a bit of discussion in the last years about whether climate finance should be public or private, and the geographical scope, etc. And there was actually an important COP decision in Cancun 2010, which states that climate finance should be mobilized by the industrialized countries, and they should take a lead here. It should be balanced between adaptation and mitigation, and really important that it should be new and additional. It should just not be relabeled ODA or just renamed funds and sources that are flowing anyway, but that it should be on top of what already happens in terms of development cooperation, for example. And however, in the last few years, especially as with the Paris Agreement, the scope is broadening a little bit. So now there is an emerging consensus that we need to look at all sources, not only public funds, that it really should come from a variety of sources, innovative sources, and it should be also geographically a bit broader, because at the end of the day, the climate, the Paris Agreement says that all climate, all financial flows should be compatible with the Paris Agreement, with the pathway towards low greenhouse gas emissions and resilient development. And for that, basically, we need to look at much more than only international public money. Next slide, please. And this is why when you look at NDCs and implementing climate action in your countries, or be it at a national, subnational, or even regional level, you need to look at all these different sources. There's a domestic or international money, there's bilateral, multilateral, public and private. All of that needs to be taken into account. All of that needs to be made climate compatible and Paris compatible at the end of the day. This is what we need to there's this phrase of shifting the trillions, of really moving all financial flows towards that common goal of achieving the Paris target and keeping global warming well below 2 degrees. Next, please. However, what we are focusing on now is basically the middle pillar is international public funds, to explain a little bit the climate finance landscape. So this is basically the topic of today, although of course there much more can be said about all the other sources. So I think could you click once or twice again, Krishna? There should be a little animation. Exactly, that is enough. Thank you very much. So just to give a bit of orientation, we are looking at climate funds that are inside what we call the UNFCCC regime, so the International Climate Regime, or the rules and regulations and institutions around the international climate negotiations. And there are some funds that are directly under that UNFCCC regime. Then there are some climate funds that are outside of it, but they're still multilateral. They are mostly managed by the World Bank. And then there are, in the third layer, there are also funds that are bilateral or sometimes also regional initiatives. So donor countries or the European Union setting up their own climate funds. And we picked a few that we think are of relevance to you here. And due to time constraints, we cannot discuss all of them. However, hopefully that does still provide some relevant insights. And because we have a special guest here today with Ina, who is presenting the City Climate Finance Gap Fund, and this also has other commitments and needs to leave soon, we will jump right into this middle column here and allow also for a few questions after her input. And yes, that's why I don't want to speak anymore, but rather hand over to you, Ina, so we can have your input. Yeah. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I will explain a little bit more about this gap fund, as we call it in short. You see, it's quite a mouthful, the full name, but exactly. The gap fund is a multi-donor initiative, as you showed in your previous slide, and it is a fund hosted by the World Bank and the European Investment Bank. And GIZ is involved in its actual implementation. So I think this is important to know. It's in that category indeed. And what makes it a bit different from some of the other funds is that it actually has this urban focus. So it's about subnational project development, which in PIDA, I know PIDA a little bit. A lot of you will work on a cross-border infrastructure, but I think it is nevertheless interesting for you because we work in the same sectors. So the information is relevant for all line ministries. For example, that could be transport, energy, or urban development. So exactly. Why do we have the focus on this subnational project development? Well, that is mostly, and Sally already touched upon them, because we see this increasing urbanization around the world. We see that the majority of people live in cities, and therefore also the majority of emissions can be found in cities, and the majority of threats to livelihoods. But for example, also threats to flooding is something that we see more and more in cities. So that is the place to intervene to achieve these goals of the Paris Agreement. Of course, not only. I mean, that should be very clear. There should always be a balance. But for this fund, that is the focus. There are also specific difficulties for subnational project development. So you see, if you develop a project and maybe it is at a national level, it's a big train line, there will be a high role, an important role for the ministries, for example, with a lot of capacities and access to sovereign lending, etc. If you have a big private investment, say a solar park, then usually this private sector can invest, has the funds, the capacities to invest. But on the subnational level, so cities, metropolitan areas, maybe also regions, we see that there's big problems in developing projects and preparing projects as well as finding funding, because very often a municipality, for example, in most countries cannot directly lend internationally. So, and for good reasons, but it means it's even more complicated than national projects. So when we look at the scope of the GAP fund, it is for early stage project preparation. So I think what is very important to realize, there are some funds to prepare projects. These are not investment funds in this case. So it is not to build something, it's to prepare to build something. It's to prepare to find financing to build something. So as an example, it is when a city is aware, okay, we have a big problem with our transportations, we have traffic jams, we have problems with the air quality, all those cars are, and cars in many African cities, of course, car ownership is rising very fast, a lot of cities cannot absorb. So you know there is a problem, the city will think, okay, maybe a metro line, maybe a bus rapid transit, maybe also non-motorized transport, you can look into, can we make it more attractive to walk? So these are all options, but you do not know yet what you're going to invest in. So that is this early stage of project preparation. Or maybe you have decided what to invest in, but you don't know how yet. So you know it, you want a bus rapid transit, you know it's the best solution, but exactly where will the bus stops be, how will we invest, how will we prepare, what will be the impact? This is where this fund comes in. So under this fund, technical assistance, so advisory, will be provided. What will not be provided is investment itself, so buying the buses, so to say, or preparing a loan. But we will provide guidance, advisory, so manpower, so to say, to prepare projects. Sustainable is actually the funds to prepare. So what will not be available is that funds will be made available for the city to hire people. So I think that is important to be aware of these limitations or the specific place where this fund works. Yes, if we then look at eligibility, so who can apply for finance? So geographically, it's very broad. So it's low and middle income countries. So simply said, I think all African countries are part of that, are eligible as such. It will also work on adaptation and mitigation. So if we look, for example, at sectors or type of investments, you can think of what I said, public and non-motorized transport. We can look at energy, especially energy efficiency, I think is very important for cities. So reduce the consumption of energy within the city. Waste management. Waste has a big impact on emissions. Wastewater can also be a very important. So sewage systems and making sure this wastewater is transported to rivers or the sea clean, and that emissions are not going everywhere. And then, of course, the adaptation. So in adaptation, you can think of, for example, flood protection. There is a number of coastal cities where this is highly relevant. Some mega cities, even if we look at Lagos, Nigeria, Dar es Salaam, coastal cities where flood protection could be of high relevance. For example, also green spaces within the city. It will be demand driven, so based on demands, so on applications, so to say. There's no time pressure with that. The initiative is very, very new, and I'm telling you very openly that we're not completely up and running. So in that sense, there's time enough to spread this information within your ministries without a high pressure to apply immediately. The fund will be active at least for the coming 5 years. And it will also not be on a first-come, first-served basis. We will actually look on eligibility and quality of the project. That is, okay, is it urban? Is it climate change mitigation or adaptation? Is there good social and environmental co-benefits? If we go back to public transport, social benefits can be very high if you connect the suburb or poorer areas with the city center, for example. Environmental co-benefits can be very high if you can reduce soot and particulate matter, so basically improve air quality. So there's a lot more you can do with these projects than just work on climate. There will also be a priority for high-impact projects and NDC alignment. So again, we get back to this topic of the national determined contribution. So what have the countries pledged under the Paris Agreement? So there it will be very important to look at the national pledges. We will always do that when we get when we receive applications, that we look at what is the national pledges. Maybe national pledges is specifically to look at the transport sector or the energy sector, etc. So we will definitely also look in that into that. I will briefly look whether I have told you everything I wanted to do. I think so. I would like to also refer to you to the website, so citygapfund.org. You will find it here in the slides. The slides will be sent to everyone, I've understood, so you will have it there and you will simply be able to click on it. There is ample information there. So if you want to check eligibility, if you want to share it within your ministry, share it with cities you know, you're working with regions you know, please do so. There's a lot of information there, and that is also where you can apply. So there's a button on the top right corner where you can apply for this support. As said, no hurries, but we would definitely be very interested to receive applications. If cities are not sure, there's also a way to contact us before you send in an application. Maybe you want to check with us, and us, I mean, that is World Bank and EIB, the European Investment Bank, and GIZ. We all do that together. Through the website, you can contact this technical secretariat and discuss with us before. If you say, I don't want to, you know, waste my resources on an application that maybe is not eligible. So we're very open for this kind of exchange. At the moment, as said, we're building up, so we might be not the fastest yet, but by December we'll have the full team on board, and we'll definitely be more responsive, quicker, and hopefully very soon to implement this. So yes, I'll leave it here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ina. I think that was very, very interesting. So maybe we will now invite questions. You can either raise your hand or type the question in the chat box. And in the meantime, maybe I can make a slight kind of link to the PIDAPAP2 project. Hello.
Only.
One second. I need to mute some people. No, sorry. Yeah.
Eh?
Okay, so as I was saying, PIDAPAP2 is the next round of infrastructure projects across four sectors. So energy, transport, transboundary water, and ICT. And we are in the final stages of selecting a short list of priority list of projects from a long list of over 200 projects submitted since March, April this year. And these will be approved, the shortlist will be approved at the level of the Heads of State Summit early next year. So just in a nutshell, to tell you that there is, the PIDAPAP2 has learned from the first phase, PIDAPAP1, which was carried out over the last 10 years. And then there is a criteria called life cycle GHG emission, which gives a premium, gives a score to projects that have the lowest life cycle emission within the region. So projects compete within regions, and the cleanest projects in any sector improve their ranking, because the principle, maybe for those who don't know, is that the regions, there are five regions in Africa: north, south, northern, southern, eastern, western, and central, submit projects, and then we pick the 10 best from each region. So in that competition, life cycle greenhouse gas emission of the project is one criteria. The other criteria, which is related to what we're discussing here, is the corridor overlap criteria. So basically, in line with trying to reach the integrated corridor approach. It's a little similar to the sustainable urban planning. Sustainable urban planning, it has to do with the compact cities, resource efficient, energy efficient, etc. But integrated corridor is the same principle, but across cities. So you would have like corridors emerging, like the Abidjan-Lagos corridor, which is one of the most, I would say, active ones on the continent. And there you will see a number of cities, and then you would see a kind of continuous urbanization along these corridors, and with trade, industrialization, etc. So that tends to group, to concentrate the urbanization in Africa in efficient corridors, which is the same principle as the sustainable urbanization. So members, colleagues, please, do you have any questions before Ina can address, because I think she will have to leave in some moments. Please raise your hand. Yeah, there's a comment on the presentation. Yes, we can email it to that address, but it will be posted on the website, on the PDAPAP website. We will post the presentation to everybody, for everybody.
Krishna, I don't see how to raise my hand, so I just
Okay, just go on. Just unmute yourself and then ask your question then. Maybe introduce yourself. I mean, is that Sally?
This is Sally speaking again. I just was wondering if Ina could say anything about is there sort of a scope in terms of the size of monetary amounts that could be accessed for these types of preparatory activities?
Yes, thank you. Yes and no, in the sense that monetary amounts are not, money is not transferred. So in that sense, that does not apply, but I do know what you mean and do understand what you mean. And we should look at around 100,000 euros per project as a very rough support number. This, of course, depends a lot on how big the project is and will be. So it's very different if the need for support is very different. If you want to work on green spaces in the city or a big waste system that costs 100 million. A US dollar investment. So there's a big scope, and of course we will not provide the highest amount of support to the smallest project. So this will be very vary per type of project, and we will be learning. So in that sense, everything we have, luckily from our donors, the freedom to learn from what we do and to see what actual requests are coming in. Please remember that we are not going to cities and propose support. They will have to request us to make sure that we do the right thing and something that is really needed. So in that sense, that could also look different 2 years from now, if and when we've learned that we need something else or the cities need something else. And please be aware that no money will be transferred, but advisory will be provided.
Okay.
And on that letter, a small addition from me. So there's no minimum investment amount for the project, but we do see, as we look for bigger impact, that a very small project, maybe revamping one park, it will be hard for them for this kind of projects to compete with slightly bigger projects, such as a bus line, bus rapid transit, or a waste management, etc. Which is not to say that we will only do big projects. We will look to definitely include secondary cities, so not just the cities with millions and millions of inhabitants. We will also ensure that we have projects on all continents, so that we have a fair share, at least a fair share of African projects in comparison, for example, to Latin America or Asia. Yes. Yeah, and I see the questions, whether it's only targeting projects with PDAPAP2. No, it's not related at all. using this platform to present it, but it's not not related.
Yeah, so I saw the question, I think, from Bongani. No, the answer is, as we explained, PDAPAP2 is about cross-border projects, cross-regional projects. So it may be difficult for the, maybe the other question would be, can you fund cross projects outside cities? Ina, I guess that would be no. You would only focus on the cities.
Yes, we only focus on urban projects. So if you say, and it's a little bit, for example, a waste management is usually built on the outskirts of the city, of course. Yeah. But it is such a strong connection to the city because it will work on the waste problem in the city. So we still mention that. We will still call that an urban project. For example, a train connection through the country, will not be eligible.
Okay. I have maybe a question related to what you actually you started answering it in your last reply. You mentioned secondary cities, and this is a very, very very important phenomenon. We often talk about the Lagos, the Abidjans, the large cities, but we tend to forget there are probably hundreds of 1 million inhabitants. So I think that's the definition of secondary, 1 million inhabitant cities. But then the PDAPAP2 definition, actually, PIDA has a very interesting definition of rural versus urban, because there is also another criteria in PIDA, which is the rural connectivity. So the definition of rural in PIDA is anything which is less than 50,000 people is considered rural. So any small town above 50,000 is not rural. Obviously, it's not a town yet, certainly not a city. But then my question would be, how small city or town can you look at? I mean, what is your cutoff point, lower cutoff point, lower limit, in terms of size of the municipality making the request?
Yes, we do not have that in a number. And the reason for that is that there we work globally. In China, everything under 5 million inhabitants is called a secondary city. Mm. But for example, for Lesotho, that's a very different way of measuring what is a city and what not. So we have on purpose no number, but it should be possible for a city to develop a project that has a couple of million euro or US dollar investment capacity. So that can be very different per region, per continent. So that is why we refrain from saying numbers, because if we say it has to be a certain number, then the difference between China and Africa will just be too big.
Okay. Yes, I think Dr. Camus, I saw your remark. Yes, the presentation will be posted tomorrow on the PDAPAP2 website, as usual, including the recordings, actually. So if you missed the start, you can always listen to the recording and download the presentation on the website. So yeah, I think this is very interesting, although not directly relevant for PDAPAP2 projects, but certainly many of you are from the RECs and the member states, obviously, because of the trends in urbanization now, this is a movement that cannot be neglected, and these funds actually would help to prepare these city projects, these urbanization projects, which then, as I explained, there should be actually a strong linkage between the cities and what happens between the cities, so the corridors, which is actually one of the key strategic criteria for PIDA to select projects. PIDA is now focusing, because we have such a large number, over 200, and we need to pick the best 50 to 60 projects. We are now looking at which are these projects, those projects that really contribute to very strategic corridors in Africa. Okay, so maybe last round, a last call for questions, and then if there are no further questions, we can move to the rest of the presentation, because Ina, I think, will have to leave. Yeah, Ina will have to leave now. So probably, if there are no questions, I think we should move to the rest of the presentation, and then we can take a second round of questions on the balance of the presentation.
Exactly, that's what we will do. Thank you very much, Ina, for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Welcome. Ina, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye. Bye. Ina.
Please.
Bye.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Krishna. Over the next 8 slides, I will introduce a few more climate funds to you. And then we will also briefly discuss a few project examples to make this a little more tangible and hopefully more relevant for your work. And yeah, we would propose to then have another longer round of question answers, if that is okay. So, we left the overview slide, but if in case you still remember, we had this climate finance landscape with the 3 different categories of funds. So those around the UNFCCC, which is the, yeah, thank you, Krishna. I think 2 or 3 clicks away. One more? No, sorry, in the other direction. forward. Here we are. Thank you. Excellent, Krishna. And one more, because then we get the red circles. Perfect. Thanks very much. Yeah, sorry for having to jump in the presentation, but we thought it's too nice an opportunity to have Ina with us in person, who can speak really in person on one of these funds, to miss it. And that's why we decided to disrupt the program a little bit. Apologies for that. So yeah, as I said before, we have these different categories of funds. Some of them are really tied to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Other are multilateral, most of them being really run by the World Bank, as we just heard in the example of that Ina presented, in cooperation also with EIB and GIZ, but still these are quite heavily dominated by the World Bank. And then we have the third category, which is bilateral funds by individual donors or a group of donors, such as the European Union or just like a smaller subset. And we will now look at a few of those in a little bit more detail, although not too much detail, so we still have time to discuss examples. Krishna, please, could you jump? Yes, perfect. Yeah, just before the Jeff. Exactly. Thank you very much. So the Global Environment Facility, or short GEF, is actually the financial mechanism of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. It was created already back in the 90s after this famous conference in Rio de Janeiro, where the climate Framework Convention, the Convention on Biodiversity and on Combating Desertification were all adopted, and the GEF served as the financial mechanism for many years until the Green Climate Fund came into the picture. Just that as a little background. So the GEF is helping countries to meet the obligations they have under the UN Framework Convention, for example, reporting requirements. So often if you see that a national communication of a certain country, you see in the imprint that the GEF has actually financed it. So it's really enabling countries that are parties to that convention to really meet the obligations. Then in addition, the GEF has several relevant climate funds under its hood, so to say. There is the GEF Trust Fund, mostly for larger mitigation projects. And then there are 2 funds that are relevant, especially for least developed countries and for other very vulnerable countries, that is focusing on climate adaptation. These are the Least Developed Countries Fund, LDCF, and the Special Climate Change Fund, SCCF. And you can access the GEF through accredited entities or through multilateral entities. And these are, for example, UNDP, UNEP, the World Food Program, FAO, etc. So the usual suspects, so to say, that can help you or can help a country getting access to the GEF. The GEF also experimented a little bit with direct access, and there are a few international organizations such as WWF or IUCN that are accredited. And they did that a few years ago to also meet a bit of the criticism that the GEF was confronted with initially, that it's a very donor-dominated enterprise. And this was an attempt to really meet this criticism and make it more accessible. However, they also closed the group of GEF agencies at some point. So it's just roughly a dozen that have direct access. So mostly you would go through perhaps your local UNDP or UNEP country office or regional office to get access to the GEF. Then next slide, please. There's also the Adaptation Fund. The Adaptation Fund is interesting because it's not under the UN Framework Convention, but under the Kyoto Protocol. Many of you might remember that the Kyoto Protocol was the first time that countries really had legally binding emission reduction commitments to meet. I mean, that was before we had basically the more global approach of the Paris Agreement. At the time of the Kyoto Protocol, it was only industrialized countries that were supposed to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And so there are also parties to that Kyoto Protocol. And the Adaptation Fund is under that protocol, and only parties to that were eligible to access it. Now that we have the Paris Agreement, the Adaptation Fund was basically moved under the Paris Agreement. So there was a decision, I think two COPs away in the Fiji COP, that the Adaptation Fund will now serve the Paris Agreement. So it's now also under the same, so to say, legal treaty. But originally it was under the KP. And why is it interesting? Because the Adaptation Fund was financed from a 2% levy or a tax on the sales of emission reduction certificates. So basically it leveraged money from the carbon market. And that is interesting because this money already basically belonged, if you want to say, to the recipient countries. It was not different from the GEF, where you had to negotiate between the donors and the recipients. This Adaptation Fund money was already there, basically was already reserved for the recipient countries, and it had an automatic, so to say, source. Unfortunately, the carbon market really went down and the Adaptation Fund nearly dried up and is now dependent on bilateral pledges from donor countries. So it is always in a bit of a precarious situation. But however, it really has done a really important groundwork. It piloted several important aspects. For example, it piloted direct access of national implementing entities and of regional implementing entities. So now you didn't have to go through UNDP, UNEP, etc. anymore, but you could accredit your own climate fund at the national level, or your own institution, could be a ministry and a research institute, etc., to get direct access to the Adaptation Fund. And that was a really groundbreaking thing. And the Adaptation Fund has already 32 direct entities accredited, for example, in Africa. Yes, I think we can already move to the next. The Green Climate Fund is basically the newest addition to the family of funds that are located at the International Climate Regime. So it was created in 2010 already back in Cancun, but then got operational a few years later, and is now together with the Global Environment Facility, the financial mechanism of the convention, is also by far the largest fund. So its portfolio at the moment is worth more than 20 billion. A considerable part is already under implementation, and And finance is not only adaptation, but mitigation and adaptation. And it has the objective of channeling like a major part of global climate finance flows to address climate change. It learned a lot from the experiences with the Adaptation Fund. For example, also here we have a really strong focus on vulnerable countries, on LDCs, SIDS in Africa. It, in its portfolio, it attempts to achieve a balance between mitigation and adaptation of 50-50 over time. And of this 50% adaptation, another 50% subset is really particularly for LDC SIDS and Africa. And its portfolio has already quite a few projects in Africa. And here also country ownership is very important, very similar to the Adaptation Fund. Direct access is possible through national and regional accredited entities. There is basically a national bottleneck. There's something they call the national designated authority that needs to provide a no objection letter, really making sure that the funding of the Green Climate Fund really meets the priorities of the country and not just the priority of the project implementer, the implementing agency or the entity that wrote the proposal, etc. So there's really a watchdog role here, making sure that the interests of the country, of the host country, are really met, and that it's well aligned with the national priorities is really very, very important. The Green Climate Fund also created something new in terms of access. Now also subnational entities can access the Green Climate Fund, and international entities. For example, GIZ is one of them. So it can be some enterprises, some international banks, and some organizations such as GIZ development organizations, and quite a few other. This is a new feature that the Green Climate Fund has that the previous ones did not have. So that's also worth mentioning. The Green Climate Fund, as I said, is the largest, and also has this objective of really playing a major role in global climate finance flows, and is at the same time also quite challenging for project proponents and project developers. As, it asks really for proving that a project will achieve a paradigm shift in how things are being done. That, for example, it could transform an entire sector, or really changing how things are being done in a certain region, in a certain sector, and really making a considerable contribution to meeting the Paris targets. I think we come back to that also later in our project example. Perhaps now let's move to the next one. Thank you. Exactly. So there are a few more that are worth mentioning here. So this is one of these bilateral initiatives that I mentioned. It's a bilateral German climate fund called the International Climate Initiative, or ICI, how it's being dubbed. It's also around since a while. It finances mitigation, adaptation, conservation of carbon sinks, basically REDD+, and also biodiversity. That's perhaps a bit interesting because it broadens the scope of only climate finance. It also does biodiversity financing. Also, the ICI is really asking for proof of of innovativeness or of transformation potential. It has several safeguards that have to be met. Now there are also requirements for transparency and newly digital solutions. So quite a few requirements that have to be met also to be successful in applying for the ICI. How you access this is directly. So organizations can send an application directly. There's no need to go through an accredited entity or anything like that. However, there's a requirement to build a consortium. So the ICI also has this tendency of growing bigger and requiring applicants to form up a partnership or a team to get access to the ICI. yeah, perhaps later on that more. Can we move to the next, please? Thank you. The NAMA facility is also, we also call it a bilateral fund, although there are now several countries that are funding the NAMA facility. I think several European countries, I think the newest addition was Ireland recently, but it was started by the UK and by Germany. And the idea was to finance NAMAs. At the time, these were nationally determined mitigation actions. In other words, mitigation action in developing countries, because back in the time of the Kyoto Protocol, developing countries did not have any requirements and obligations to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. However, as became pretty obvious that their international targets were not met, that we were not at all collectively being able to address anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, there was an urging movement of incentivizing in developing countries to also reduce their emissions domestically. And this was called NAMAs at the time. And the NAMA facility was created to exactly help them doing that, to provide financing into developing countries and emerging economies to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And the NAMA facility is actually also quite ambitious and demanding in its requirements. It wants to see ambition when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. So it should be a high impact project proposal with regard to emission, but also with regards to financing. So it does require project proponents to mobilize co-financing, usually from the host government, but also private financing from the private sector in order to get money from the NAMA facility. And yeah, again, here there's no need to go through an accredited entity. However, also here, country ownership is really important because it's actually the host government. So it's the Ministry of Industry, the Ministry of Environment, the Ministry of Forestry or Planning or whatever it is to submit the application. It's not, for example, GIZ, just to give an example, that submits the application. That's really important here. Again, country ownership is very, very important. Okay, perhaps we can... Yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention something. Sorry, Krishna, could you go back one more time? Exactly. So because you were speaking about green recovery and how important that is at the moment to think basically both how to overcome this global crisis and at the same time not get us locked into old technology and high carbon technologies and processes, the NAMA facility also added additional money to its next call in what they call the Ambition Initiative, and they top up their funding to also address green recovery here in their funding efforts. So that's also relevant quite explicitly in this climate fund, but also many others do address that challenge. Thank you, Krishna. Now we can move to the next, yeah. So the last fund we introduce here, but rather briefly, is called the German Climate and Technology Initiative, or DKTI. And that the special feature of this climate fund that is really trying to link technical assistance with financial assistance. So here KfW and GIZ are eligible for funding, and ideally these two instruments really work needlessly together and complement each other. There's a strong focus on technology and also on markets and market potentials. And in theory, it finances mitigation, adaptation, and technology transfer. And there are usually annual calls for proposals. However, at the moment, there's a little bit of uncertainty around the next round. So we're not going to go into much detail here. But yeah, we did provide links to two projects. One, for example, on Biogas Brazil, another one, solar clusters in Morocco, which perhaps if interested, you can look up later. Yes, I think here we We have the, oh no, we have two more slides before we go to the examples, I think. Thank you. Yes, Krishna, great. So just briefly to a few words on the financial instruments that are being used by these climate funds, because many of them use, not all, but a certain subset. And it's just important to keep in mind that it's not only grants. So grants perhaps is the most commonly known or well-known instrument, also like a classic development cooperation instrument, of course, but there are also more, especially for climate finance, we often need to look at more than one instrument in designing a project or proposal. So you can think along the lines of grants are usually or often used to start or accelerate a market or to finance the technical assistance that comes together with, for example, a loan or another instrument. Then loans are usually given to enterprises, households, or also public entities. Then guarantees, they are used for projects and investments, often as an incentive for both private entities and so, for example, for commercial banks to reduce the risk or just the perceived risk that they might see when giving out loans for a certain technology, to basically make it a bit easier for them to enter a new field and provide loans for example, a new climate-friendly technology that they would otherwise perceive perhaps as too risky to go in without that backing. And then equity is used for enterprises, sometimes for projects, sometimes equity is also something that is being counted in as mobilization of private finance when designing a project proposal. And to make it a bit more, just perhaps a few last sentence on the graph below, I realize it's not super great quality, but what you can see here basically is that climate finance over time, it increased and basically also all the instruments are increasing at the same time. It's roughly a span of a decade. Yeah, then next slide, Krishna. Please, thank you. These are just to give you a feeling of how one of these climate funds, the NAMA facility that I just talked about a bit before, that how that is using these instruments. So what you can clearly see is that at the very top, there are loans and guarantees, and at the very bottom, there are grants. And the majority of the projects are actually using both. So they are trying to really come from both ends, using grants through technical assistance to design technical aspects or advise on regulation, policy advice, or doing other important groundwork that is needed for example, a loan scheme to work and to take off smoothly. So without going into the details of these individual projects, it's just like a glimpse of the NAMA facility portfolio until a few years ago. And just to illustrate this point that we should not only look at one instrument alone, but usually like a combination of complementary instruments are used. And definitely we need to look beyond grants only, beyond only public international money to achieve the challenge that lies ahead, which is financing NDCs. Thank you, Krishna. I think now we move to the project example. No, not yet. All right. So I think this is really the last one then before we move to the examples. It's just illustrating the same point that also the Green Climate Fund is using various instruments, using grants and loans mostly, but also other instruments. Here, the smaller bars you can see is on the one hand guarantees and equity, but also something that we're not really touching upon today due to time constraints, which is called results-based payment. That would refer to REDD+, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. That is something that is a bit beyond the scope here, but so you have heard of it as well. Thanks, Krishna. Next. Yes, so here we go. And now we go a little bit into make it a bit more tangible, diving into some project examples. before we then go to Q&A. And I'd like to hand back to Sally, actually, for an example of a GCF project.
Okay, sure. Thanks, Ulla. So like Ulla said, we want to give you an actual example to make this a little more practical for you. So Ulla presented you with the Green Climate Fund. And she also said that it's not necessarily easy to convince the Green Climate Fund that you might be worthy of their funding. So I wanted to give you an example of a project that was successful in convincing them. So this is, unfortunately, it's not one in your region, so not in Africa, but I still thought that the topic could be of interest because it's in the water sector. And I just wanted to show this map because it is a project in Grenada, or Grenada, however you want to pronounce. And I always find it a bit remarkable because it's just so small. It's down here, right above Venezuela, if you can spot it down there. Yep, okay, thank you. And I'm always struck by it because these islands in the Eastern Caribbean, they're all just so teeny, and or at least they always appear teeny, I guess, when you're standing on it. Maybe it doesn't feel that way. But they're really out there on the front lines of one of the most active areas in the world in terms of hurricanes. And so they really are the first kind of line of defense before these hurricanes come into the Caribbean or move up either the east coast of the United States or head into the Gulf of Mexico. I'm from the US, so I'm sort of used to hearing about hurricanes my whole life, but now it is becoming more and more and more and more a problem, and in terms of the number and intensity of these hurricanes. So I picked Grenada because it is a highly vulnerable country. It has significant problems in the face of climate change, and it has now succeeded in at least convincing the GCF that it is worthy of being financed in its water sector. So the project is called Climate Resilient Water Sector in Grenada. They've come up with the acronym G-CRUSE. And this is actually being financed by two of the international funds that Ulla mentioned. So the Green Climate Fund is putting in the lion's share, and I'll get to the amounts in a second. And then the BMU, which is Germany's environment ministry, is kicking in funding as well through its international climate initiative. And so the idea is that over a six-year period, they will increase the resilience of Grenada's national water sector through a multi-pronged approach where they are going to target pretty much everyone. So they want to target the national government in terms of regulatory frameworks. They want to target the water users, both commercial and private users. They want to target the water supplier, so the water utility on the island, as well as the private sector, to in the end come up with a resilient climate solution. To a lesser extent, there will be reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. So next slide. So the aim, as I mentioned, is to mainstream and implement climate resilience throughout Grenada's entire national water sector. They are addressing two key risks. One is the availability of fresh water. So Grenada, like many, I think, small islands, relies on groundwater sources and rain catchment. And they're noticing that this is all becoming more scarce in the context of climate change. So the project should address, on the one hand, the availability, but also, and in the context of the hurricanes I mentioned, address disaster preparedness. The sectors that are being targeted are obviously the water sector, but also tourism and agriculture as the two big economic drivers, but also big time water users in the country. And to a lesser degree, the electricity subsector is being targeted with some pilot measures intended to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. So the entire population of Grenada is actually intended to benefit from this project. So we can jump to the next where we just can quickly see the challenges. I touched on a few, but we're seeing changes in temperature, changes in precipitation, the tropical storms or hurricanes, and also the sea level rise. So the changes in temperature are actually having major impacts on water availability during the dry season. They have a major deficit in terms of their water availability, which results in things like trucking water around the island to great expense or at great expense. The sea level rise is also causing increased turbidity during storms and during extreme events, as well as saltwater intrusion into their water sources. So water quality and availability is an issue. And so without decisive action to enhance their climate resilience, the people of Grenada will face increasingly serious climate-induced water scarcity over the next three decades. So that is how the project developers have framed it. Next slide, please. In terms of financing, so the Green Climate Fund is going to be putting in over 35 million euros. The government of Grenada is putting, this is, I think, primarily in-kind contributions of 4.2 million related to staff time, office space, and things like that. And then the BMU is financing two of the five components of the project with, I think that was supposed to be 2.5 million. That must be a typo, not 2 to 5 million. Yes, 2.5. So in this case, in contrast to what Ulla was saying about a mix of financing instruments, Grenada is in a bit of a special situation, and they are pretty much only eligible for grant funding. And that has a lot to do, actually, unfortunately, with the impacts that all of these hurricanes have had on their economy. Up until just a couple of years ago, their debt was outpacing their GDP. And so as part of their debt restructuring, they're not actually allowed to take on more debt in the forms of loans, which is why in this particular case, we only have grant financing for this whole project. And I just put in this, the project says already foresees that they will leverage 2.9 million in private sector contributions, but that is not considered co-financing. So next. As part of the project design, it would be, and I put this in because it would be important for you, if you were developing your own projects, to identify the key barriers that are preventing, in this case, the water sector from becoming more resilient. And so the four that were identified for this particular project related to governance, so thinking about what regulations need to be put into place, what sort of management authority needs to be put into place that can actually oversee water rights in the country. Thinking about water tariff systems, like they have a very outdated water tariff that it doesn't even cover their costs, so very practical things like that that will be looked at. The second barrier, looking at the actual users, so what are households and businesses doing with the water? How could we, or how could the project increase the efficient use of the water, things like that. Infrastructure itself, so this is an example where they're lacking storage, both in terms of the raw water and the treated water. It doesn't allow for, you know, efficient supply, and also because of the long dry spells, they need increased storage. And there's also a lack of interconnection, so there's quite a bit of kind of hardware work that needs to be done on the system. And then the fourth one is the one I mentioned already, so the public finance barrier. So, well, on the one hand, they have the problem that they're quite strapped for cash with this debt situation, but on the other hand, they also have this current water tariff that is just too low to actually be sustainable and create a resilient system. So they have to look at how they can increase supply but decrease demand at the same time so that they can reach a resilient, happy medium in the middle, which is actually on the next slide. So that is the project approach. They think by reducing supply and boosting supply and reducing demand, they will have a resilient water sector through 2050. So this idea about the paradigm shift, which Ulla mentioned, so their idea is that by tackling the problem from the various levels, so the ones that I mentioned, from the government side, from the water user side, from the water provider side, and looking at things like behavioral changes that need to happen, efficiency gains that need to happen, changes that have to happen in regulations, et cetera, and also by just raising awareness amongst the population that they will achieve the paradigm shift that the GCF is looking for in such a project. As I mentioned, the project will have five components that both have adaptation and mitigation activities. If you click to the next slide, you'll see that they are basically divided up along these lines that I mentioned. So looking at issues of water governance, looking at so targeting the national government level, and for one thing they want to do is establish a water resource management unit. In terms of the water users, they want to target households, but also farmers and the tourism businesses. And in this regard, they've included a challenge fund, which will be managed by Grenada's National Development Bank. And that's maybe interesting to mention because Grenada's National Development Bank is actually currently being groomed to be an accredited entity for the GCF, and it's being supported by the GIZ to reach this status where they can also manage funds coming from the GCF for the country. So the inclusion of them in the project is also part of a kind of capacity development element. And then the third component is looking at the supply system, so actually targeting the water authority, NAWASA, looking at issues of supply, storage, and infrastructure. And then the second two components is where the BMU, so the ICI International Climate Initiative, is kicking in money. And this is where we get the mitigation outcomes. They really want to look at efficiency issues, so how to reduce water losses, how to improve energy use in things like water pumping. They want to create a GHG inventory for the water sector. They want to assess the renewable energy options that would be available to the sector. So, like I said, that is really focused on resource efficiency in this component. And then the last component, which is quite typical, is thinking about what have we learned and how do we replicate. So in this case, as I mentioned, Grenada is quite a small country, but from the map, as you can see, there are lots of little countries out there on the eastern edge of the Caribbean or throughout the Caribbean that they believe could benefit from a similar approach to managing their water issues because they have similar issues and they think that they could use the Organization for Eastern Caribbean States, the OECS, to help upscale this work and replicate it in other Caribbean contexts. So then the last little bit is more just sort of food for thought. So based on what you've heard, does that strike you as innovative or transformative? Because these are things that these various funds, not just the GCF, but these are typically things that these climate funds want to hear. When you are proposing a project to them, they want to know, it's sort of you have to kind of strike a balance. On the one hand, they want to know that you're using best practices, that you're using proven technologies, that you have looked at what others are doing and you look for complementary approaches or ways to benefit from what has already been done. But at the same time, they want to see that you're being innovative, that you're coming up with maybe new ways to do things or new ways to finance things so that you get to that transformative level that everyone, sort of the holy grail of climate finance. So as I mentioned, they think that the innovation really comes in this multifocal approach, working at with the various stakeholders. Maybe you think using this challenge fund would be innovative. They're basically targeting the agriculture and tourism businesses with this fund, saying you can access grant funding to do specific things that will be to the broader benefit of the sector. So they're calling it post-investment grant subsidies for the implementation of water efficiency measures and rainwater harvesting. So That is sort of, I'll leave it to you maybe to think about whether you would agree or you would do it differently, but that is the Grenada project in a nutshell.
Excellent. Thank you, Sally. So now we just have just a couple of more projects just to illustrate also another fund, and then we would like to go into QA. I think that's fine, right? We still have perhaps some 5 minutes for that. Just because it's also an example from the African continent, we thought we also might show you a NAMA facility project that is from South Africa and also perhaps in a sector that might be of interest to this audience. It's the Energy Efficiency in Public Buildings and Infrastructure Program. And the overall objective is reducing greenhouse gas emissions in South Africa by catalyzing an energy efficiency transformation within the public sector. And this is supposed to be done through mitigation of investment risks and the provision of technical support. And as I said, it's a NAMA facility project implemented by GIZ, financial volume of 20 million euros. And perhaps on the next slide, we can see a few more details. Krishna, could you click next? Great, excellent, thank you. So yeah, how that works, it is actually a guarantee fund that is done with a national development finance institution. This is a typical setup for an NAMA facility project with the name is Industrial Development Corporation. And the idea is to unlock a credit line for ESCOs, these are energy service companies, and you might be familiar with them. And the NAMA facility provided these 20 million euro funding, and national government also contributed another 23 million. And they're hoping or expecting to leverage over time 91 million in the time frame of 10 years in different financial instruments, both debts, grants, and equity, just to show again that this really high ambition of leveraging additional financial resources through a NAMA facility project. That is something really they're looking for, want to see. So the mitigation objective is met by reducing energy consumption and therefore CO2 emissions. They're leveraging public and private funding. They're helping to create employment also within the sector and reducing operational costs. And operational costs for the public sector here is expected to free up financial resources to then strengthen other public services, such as energy access, healthcare, education, etc. And we were speaking about that ambition to transform entire sectors and really transform how things are being done. This year, this project here is supposed to be one where the public sector leads by example, and that this model hopefully will be adapted also in other areas, transforming the entire energy efficiency sector. So that's the South Africa example. And then I think we just have one more slide on, two more on other examples. Yeah, so here we have two countries on one slide, really briefly. One is a project in Mexico, done by KfW, another one in Brazil by GIZ, and both are targeting the housing sector. This is all, and there's also, in addition, another NAMA facility project was actually the first project they had in Mexico on housing. So this is another really relevant sector, residential or other buildings. There's a high mitigation potential. It's not just one measure alone. It's not as perhaps straightforward. However, there are lots of measures that can be implemented in the housing sector and in the combination that leads to a rather high mitigation potential. In the case of this EcoCasa project in Mexico, they have already financed more than 44,000 houses and benefited 170,000 people, and quite an remarkable emission reduction impact already achieved. And then the very last one is again an example from the African continent. Could you click one more? Thank you. Krishna is an example from Mozambique, which is more on the adaptation or resilience increasing side. That's a project where KfW and World Bank work together in preventing damages from floodings and cyclones, improving the stormwater drainage system. So I think perhaps we leave it with that here and allow for questions. Yeah, we have more material which we wanted to show you, but we are happy to provide it. But I think otherwise we might just run out of time. Perhaps it's best we break here.
You're right, Ola. We should now maybe listen to the audience and look at the questions. So let me see whether we have any hands raised.
Or if you want to type it in the chat.
Monsieur Soumana, do you have vous avez une question? Je vois votre micro est branché. No. Bon, en tout cas, je vais. Oui, Monsieur Soumana.
Non, c'était par erreur.
D'accord. Allez. Ok. Donc, very interesting. Now. Maybe in this case, contrary to the city fund, I think in this case, there is no impediments, no barrier for PIDA PAP2 projects to apply, because in the four sectors, actually across the four sectors, whether it's energy, transport, water, or ICT, if we can demonstrate what you showed, for example, in the case of GCF, the success factors you showed us, efficiency, effectiveness, sustainable development, and all that paradigm shift, as they call it. So I think there are cases in the existing PIDA PAP2 projects that would make good candidates for some of these funds, like GCF, for example. And therefore, we encourage member states, focal points, RECs to think about this, to have a look at these funds, and see how they could approach GCF maybe through some accredited agency, could be African Development Bank, GIZ, UNDP, or whatever. Relevant entity to develop a project proposal to pitch for these funds. I mean, to request these funds.
Yes, I think Krishna, I'd like to second what you said. I think in your sectors, what you described, there's a really large potential for accessing climate finance from these various sources. And as you just rightly said, for the GCF, you need to go through some accredited entities that could be at the national level, could be international ones. Often it's also really important to get into the country program. I mean, it's perhaps a bit different by a regional scope, but it's important to get on the radar and early on, definitely. Yeah. There's one raised hand, actually. Let's see.
Yeah, I can't see from here. Why? Who?
I don't know how to raise my hand, so I just heard the words "raise" or "hand raise."
In the chat. Okay, go on. Please introduce yourself and ask the question, please.
Yes, thanks very much.
Hi, Simba. Okay, Simba. Go on.
It is indeed Simba from GIZ.
Yeah.
I have perhaps three questions. I missed some of the presentation due to a choppy connection. But I gathered that you mentioned that these funds tend to fund advisory services, which would include policy, and even in the one example you gave, you sort of alluded to that fact. I think it was the Granada example where it was where infrastructure, the hardcore infrastructure itself, was only a portion of what was funded. And so my question really is, who decides this? What I mean by that is, if I come to you with, maybe not to you, but to the fund, with a, let me find an example, a solar energy project, a rollout of solar energy in a particular part of a city, but I don't actually have a plan, for example, to sell energy back in the grid, and the city may need to do some work from a policy perspective to make it more viable long term. Who would decide that, oh, actually, we think you need some more policy assistance here before we fund the hardcore infrastructure itself? So would I need to come with a full plan, and then I would then be told that, no, there's some work that needs to be done? That's the one question. The second question is, I'm wondering whether you do these funds, I may have missed it, fund subsidies. So for example, I think of the city of Cape Town when they were going through their water crisis. If, for example, they said that they're going to be funding or subsidizing households that put in pressure gauges, but they don't actually have the budget for that, I'm wondering, would they be able to apply for a fund to fund their subsidy? And then the third question is, I'm just wondering if you have a specific example of a waste management project that has been done. Thank you.
Sally, you want me to start?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm not sure I can answer all the questions sufficiently, but let me at least start. First, you were asking about who decides what type of policy work is needed, and who decides then which type of project is eligible or will be considered. So, for example, just to use one example now, the NAMA facility, where the host country, usually a line ministry, submits the project proposal. There's usually a dialogue behind going on for several months between an institution that perhaps is interested in submitting a proposal together with the national government. So just to use an example, could be, for example, be GIZ talking with their partners in the Ministry of XYZ, identifying a gap, like a potential barriers that need to be addressed, and then very quickly this policy question usually would come up. So this is what we are lacking here, like we don't have the right incentives, some certain regulation is missing, or there needs to be some sort of a strategization, prioritization process taking place. So this is usually something that comes out of the dialogue between perhaps the project proponent, could be a development partner, and the respective ministry. And then whether it's eligible or not, that there are some eligibility criteria which you find on the website of the fund. Later in the slides, which you will actually get, we provided some links to the different funds, and there you find things like frequently asked questions documents, general information documents, where you, for example, find these eligibility, but also the ambition criteria. So the really the need to, and the more abstract perhaps criteria. And in the case of the NAMA facility, it is a roster of experts that is used by the technical support unit that screens all the project proposals and picks out those that they think have the biggest potential, biggest impact, etc. So that is not always really easy to say which one might be successful or not. I mean, we have seen a lot of very interesting things that in the end still didn't get funding. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but yeah, perhaps at least partially. Then water subsidies, not entirely sure. Perhaps it's something that Sally would know from the Grenada example, but waste management, there is a NAMA facility waste management project in China that so successfully applied for a few years ago. That's something you could look for as reference for sure.
Yeah, I would add on the first question about not quite knowing exactly what the policy situation is before you launch into a project, a couple of things. First of all, the example you gave about needing to do that legwork ahead of time to understand what the policy environment would be to sell energy back to the grid. That actually sounds like it would fit quite well with what Ina just described. Like you could approach the GAP fund and say, this is exactly the situation that we have. Can you help us figure out exactly how it would work once we have this solar park or whatever it is to be able to sell energy back onto the grid? And this is also just every single project proposal that you put forward is going to have to list the risks. And so of course, the donor is going to say, well, what if we say yes, and then the political situation is such that there is absolutely no possible way that this solar park can sell energy back onto the grid, and then we've built a solar park for nothing, you know, that sort of extreme logic. And so I think every proposal is going to have to weigh those risks and convince the donor or the fund that the risks are manageable, either by saying, we already have this good faith or these first steps or these first conversations underway with the target groups, and they want to also create the correct policy environment so that this will work. I think there's always sort of this low, medium, high risk assessment that goes in to developing all of these projects, because quite frankly, at any moment, things change between the time that you put the proposal out there, and it can take a year or more, or, you know, two before the thing is even up and running. So things do change. And I think that the funds understand that. And so there just has to be sort of a good way to justify what the risks are, what the open questions are. In the case of the NAMA facility in ICI, I know that there is actually a pretty long period from the time. So you actually put forward a concept or an idea. It's not even a proposal. And then they decide whether or not they think it's worthy of pursuing. And then they will even pay you or pay, you know, the project developer to develop the proposal further. So they'll give you 6 to 8 months or something to actually develop the proposal. So you could also say, well, this is the idea. These are the things that are holding us back a little bit. But if you think it's a good idea too, then we'll use this project proposal time to address these challenges and address these open questions. So I think there are always ways kind of around it, but clearly you need to have buy-in from your partners at the governmental level so that they are with you. That's something that any fund is gonna wanna see. On the subsidies, I don't actually know. I think I know I've read a lot of Jeff proposals. I remember there was this big push a few years ago before LED lights were really big, that they wanted to switch out every light bulb with these CFL light bulbs. And this was like, there were so many projects out there where countries were trying to switch out their light bulbs. And this was basically being paid for by Jeff funding. So I would say, yes, it probably is possible to frame your subsidies in such a way that you get help through these grant fundings to somehow enable that in some way.
However, I'm not sure this light bulb kind of schemes would still work nowadays anymore. I mean, perhaps, but I think more and more also sustainability is becoming such a hardcore criteria, isn't it, in all of these funds. So also financial sustainability, whether the government is going to be able to pay these type of subsidies also after the NAMA facility or GCF or ICI financing is being phased out. So the NAMA facility, for example, explicitly asked for an exit strategy, which would exactly go into this direction, asking, okay, so once that project is over, how is that being carried over into the non development corporation world in the real world, so to say, and their expectation is it's going to be taken up by either the government or the private sector, that it will be sustainable in the long run? So that is, it's perhaps a tricky question or something, that could also be asked to the Cities Gap Fund. And what something that Sally was just mentioning, the staged approach of proposals, that's something that basically all of these funds indeed have. From the Adaptation Fund, where it's just a two-pager at the very beginning, and then it becomes a fully developed proposal of several hundred pages, to the GCF, where already the concept note is a considerable amount of work and money, and there's anything in between. Completely correct, but there are possibilities to kind of test the waters before you submit your full-fledged proposal. And another thing, yes, Ali, I do agree, the country ownership is really so important. And if you have your host government, your ministry with you on the side, your partnership with some key actors, that is making a really strong case. And that is really something that is required, the right alignment and a stable partnership. These are important factors, which also we have later in the slides. So please take a look if you like for future reference.
Yes, thank you, Sally and Ula. I think Simba joined us late. So Simba, I invite you to listen to the part on the Cities Fund and to look at that part of the presentation. I think it answers the questions about the city project in Cape Town that could be eligible. Maybe I can share, actually, I have a small experience. I have developed one of the GCF projects in Africa from concept to full proposal until it was approved. It was a project in Burkina Faso on rural electrification for decentralized green mini-grids. So I think, for example, GCF, from discussions, from what I know, is they are very, very participative. That is, they like to be involved very early in the stage, in the process. So they don't like when you come and say, okay, this is my project. Will you approve it or not? So they like to discuss, to orient, actually, they guide the people into how to develop even the concept note, and then guide them towards the full proposal. So maybe it's important to get in touch with them early, even before the concept note, so that they can give you their views. And if they, for example, if they say forget about it, I mean, this we don't see this as a priority, then probably you could then look at some other funds and target your project, customize your project to what the other funds can fund. So do we have any other questions from members? Maybe I have a small question. I mean, if there are no other, in PIDA, we have a number of hydro projects. We have two categories of projects in hydro. One are the large hydro dams. Large meaning, the 300, 400 megawatt, hundreds of megawatts. And then we have the small hydro, which is the multi-purpose dams, as small as 30 megawatt and up to, let's say, 100 megawatt. So what is the trend, actually? Is hydro still on the radar? I mean, is hydro being, what are your views about hydropower? Is it still a priority? Because one of the things I think I have noted is that the additionality component, that is, these funds do not now tend not to fund the standard projects, like the standard solar PV farm is no longer, why would they fund it? Because solar PV technology is so cheap. But they also tend to look at the more innovative, the more challenging ones that really need a push. So what are your views on this?
I have only one experience to share here. There was an idea for a NAMA facility mini hydro project in Madagascar a few years ago. And we actually found it quite, the idea really good. And also the climate rationale quite compelling, because the point was that a lot of these schemes were not in particularly good shape, and there was the threat that at the moment there would a lot of thermal capacity be added if these hydro schemes were not renovated, improved, increased, etc. Nevertheless, it was not funded, and I cannot really tell you why. It's difficult, I don't really have an answer to that. I would still think it's important, it makes sense. It depends, of course, always on the context, but there would be a case for it. But yeah, I've only seen one, and at the end of the day, I mean, we also don't really have insights in what gets funded, why, and what else doesn't. And you can only see a certain tendency with some funds, like a certain appetite or preference, perhaps for certain countries, regions, or technologies. But then there are also exceptions, so that's difficult to tell. I would still think it's relevant. But yeah, perhaps again a question of, as you just rightly said, starting the dialogue really early and reaching out and testing the waters.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have great insights into it either. I can say that certain funds are open to discussing anything. The ICKY is maybe a little bit different in the sense that they come up with themes every year. And so they might come up when they do a call once a year. And I think it's coming up soon, the next call in November or December. And no one really knows until it's published exactly what the themes are going to be. But you can kind of guess based on what the hot topics have been in the past year, what the themes are going to be. So surely green recovery is going to fit into the theme somehow in the next call. But I don't know that they would necessarily hone in on hydro, for instance. But in that regard, they're a little bit more limiting. You have to make your proposal fit within one of their themes. But the others, like the NAMA facility, they just really want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so I don't know if they're as picky, but I have less experience with the NAMA facility, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, they also have a tendency for not, for example, financing like smaller scale things such as efficient cook stoves or things like that. So rather like think big. But then on the other hand, they did finance one, I think, in Burkina. So it's not always that easy to.
maybe still, if there's still no other questions from the audience, I would like to maybe raise one theme, one possibility. What are the prospects? Let's say, let's focus on PIDA PUP 2. And we know that one of the emerging sectors, one of the popular sectors that actually we tend to support is railways. You know, rails are way more energy efficient. Railway transport is much more energy efficient than road transport, for example. But then if you electrify the rail, and then if somehow down the line, you know that your grid factor is fairly clean. That is, you will use renewable sources, you will inject solar PV, hydro and all that. And then it makes a lot of sense. That is, you're displacing lorries, you're displacing diesel, you're displacing diesel locomotives. So my question is it feasible, let's say, at the level of either regions, RECs, or even the African Union, to think of a kind of a electrification program? That is a kind of an umbrella, I would say, a kind of a fund that would, on a continental level, let's say, okay, let's pitch for a fund that will aim at electrifying, I don't know, half of the new ones, the upgraded ones, but still running on diesel, as a program. Do you think that is feasible? I mean, and which, where should we pitch this kind of idea?
I think it's great. I think it absolutely would be a good idea, and it would probably require, when you think of the various elements that would be involved, it would probably require a mix of resources, because you probably would need the technical advisory support coming from grants, but maybe also the multilateral development banks to come in and try to structure the infrastructure aspects of it. And obviously the private sector, I don't know how the railways work in the countries that you're speaking about, if they're more publicly or privately run, but it sounds like a very interesting idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it's mostly public, but the African Union actually right now is focusing on upgrading and then standardizing to standard gauge, for example, because we also have the older meter gauge, and AUC, for example, is only now looking at promoting the standard gauge rail, which is the same width across the continent, so that then you can connect the networks and trains can run from one end to the other end. So they are in this process, but then down the line, I guess the next step would be to how do we now, the new ones are already electrified, like, you know, the Djibouti Addis is already electric railway, but there may be some others that are still operating on diesel and that would eventually switch to electricity when it's available, but that could be a dedicated program to accelerate this process.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great.
Yeah.
For example, with the JEF, you see a lot of regional proposals. They don't have to be just national. They could be rather large in geographical scope. The IKI, not sure content-wise whether that is too big, but perhaps, yeah, if you think in consortia, or in theory, for sure, they do appreciate regional approaches. So I think, yeah, that's something real worth thinking forward.
Good. So I think we've exceeded the time already, and probably if there are no other questions, do we have any questions from the audience? Let me look at the chat. Yes, I think I can see Mr. Sanalas trying to speak. Monsieur Ali Mohamed Sanalas, do you have a question?
No, it's okay.
Ah, okay. So, yeah. So I think we don't have any more questions.
We have more material in the slides,
yes.
A few references, some ideas, just hints and on project preparation, some more info on alignment, and some resources you could use and tap in, resources to get orientation on climate finance sources, on technical tools, etc. So yeah, feel free to browse them. And if there are any follow-up questions, I'm sure the colleagues Krishna and Rasmus can liaise.
Yeah, so there are many questions about the presentation. So it's a 22 megabyte presentation, but it will be posted on our PDAPACTO website. Most of you are registered focal points, so you have access to everything. And just go there, you can download. And if you are late today, you can always listen to the full recording, which will be posted also on the website tomorrow, the PDAPACTO website. Maybe just as a reminder, I will post the link in the chat for those who are new. And then eventually, if you're not registered, just register, go ahead, register, and we will give you access. So this is the link to the PDAPACTO website, where you can access actually not only this one, all the other webinars, the 24 webinars we carried out since April are available, the recordings and the full materials, including all the training material we used all over the process since the beginning. Okay, colleagues, so again, I would like to thank you all we're coming to a close now. If there are no other further questions, we can close, I think. So I would like to thank you all for your presence today and to the brilliant presentations on this very important topic, which, as you said, has been kind of sidelined, I would say temporarily, because of the COVID pandemic. But then my view is that the we should now be focusing on the recovery, the post-COVID recovery. And I think that recovery should actually be focused on inclusive green growth. I think I'm personally convinced that green growth, inclusive green growth, is a large part of the answer, because we have lost probably a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of progress made in poverty reduction, in sustainable development, has been lost through this recession, global recession, and there should be, to my mind, a very dedicated effort to steer the recovery in a more inclusive, green way, dimension.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks for having us. We wish you all good luck with developing your ideas. It's exciting.
Yes. Thank you, Sally. Thank you, Ula, also.
Thank you, Krishna. Please. Thank you, everybody, for your patience, time, participation, and questions.
Yeah. So thank you all. And I think we'll let you know about our next sessions, which will focus, I think, for the next two sessions, we'll be focusing mostly on gender. And we will send you the invites very soon for these two gender webinars. Okay, so thank you, and see you soon.
Thank you, Mr. Kuna. Merci beaucoup encore une fois.
Bye.
Bon après-midi.
Merci.
Thank you, bye.
Merci, merci à tout le monde. Merci, bye.